We're happy to welcome back to the program our friend, writer Colin Fleming, his newest book, Scrooge, a look at the 1951 classic film through the lens of horror movies, is available now. Hello there, Colin.
How's it going, Kimball?
Outstanding. How are you today?
I am still fighting the war, so the same old, but it's good to hear your voice. Got back to running the stairs today and doing my nighttime ablutions as I get ready to speak to you. I get a lot done in that little interval before I come on. I make hibiscus for my blood pressure. I put some stuff under my eyes to keep me young looking and all this good stuff.
Well, I mean, it's clearly working based on the pictures I've seen here. Do you have heat? That's a big question. That's a need this time of year.
I do. I'm back in the heat game, which is pretty exciting. The plumber came over on Saturday morning, and you'll like this. So I had two problems. The heat had gone out in my hovel of an apartment, and also I hadn't had hot water in the shower since July. And so I had to go every time I took a shower. I had to let out the Zulu warrior yelp to be able to face the cold. It was really just not pleasant. So there's this knob on the heater, and he says, did you try turning this to the right? I thought it was best I didn't touch it. And so that worked. I came back out. I'm like, kind of anticlimactic, huh, was it?
So you were, in a sense, your own heat miser.
I was, and it's funny, as you say that, I also just made the snow miser the wallpaper on my phone as I was waiting to come on, get in the festive mood. But you know what? It makes perfect sense, Kimball, that I didn't think to turn that knob. And this is why I was rubbish at every ACT, SAT. My IQ was like 60, because I never understood the questions. I applied a different logic that I think went beyond, because it wouldn't seem that you would even have the option to just freeze your ass off indefinitely, right? Because no one would select that. So I figured if you turn the heat in the shower all the way to like the fiery red, then that means that no matter what the burner is set to, it's going to come out. It's really logical that it's going to come out with some warmth, not like this sucks, I'm freezing, I'm screaming here in the tub.
See, that's the problem, using logic in an illogical world.
I read these questions like when I took the SAT, like the verbal. I got like 100 because the questions didn't make sense the way that I think the people writing them thought they did. So I saw through that. So I'm like, are you asking this actual thing that you're saying or this thing that you think you're saying? It really just messed me up big time when I took that. That's why, like, when people are like, they have an amazing IQ. It's like Dylan's IQ is 87. Like, you think you're smarter than them? Like, probably not.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Now, we've got a few topics to cover this week. Let's begin with what you have accurately called the saddest holiday radio program you'll ever hear, from 1949, an episode of Dragnet with Jack Webb. And maybe the title gave away what was to come, but perhaps not the depth of how low they would go with 22 Rifle for Christmas.
I think we should start off by saying, since this is the season of charity, that this is still nowhere near as depressing as that suspense episode that we talked about a few weeks back.
I would agree.
That was like, I mean, nothing really. That was beyond the pale. This, though, in the holiday vein, holiday open up a vein, is pretty bad. And I'll say this for Dragnet. It's good on the radio. It's a solid show, and it's highly detailed, and you can learn a lot from it. But one thing Dragnet is not ever is humorous or light, which I think is a weakness in the show, because no matter what grim profession you're in, the grim situation that you're going through, there are moments of levity. Well, I just gave you one. Oh, it was anticlimactic with the whole knob thing. So that stands out like within my day, and Dragnet doesn't do that. And for this Christmas episode, a boy, a very young boy, about the age of your boy, right?
Yeah.
Like somewhere around there. They're like, here, have a gun. And it just weirdly sort of melds with some of the things that are happening in our culture and our country too at the same time. Like you hear these like crazy stories, and this is 1949, and the episode aired on, I believe it's a Thursday, December 22nd, and that's actually the day the episode like takes place like on a Thursday, like December 22nd. So they really line this up. And this kid gets a gun, and it's the mid-century, so it's not like getting a gun in 1781 when you had to fend off the bears when you went out berry picking. And there's not really a crime committed, but something quite bad, and then it just gets worse from there. You'd think like the actual bad thing is going to be the bad thing, but it's really just the beginning of the whole succession of horrific, horrific things.
Oh, and the father, my Lord, it's just heartbreaking. And they just linger on him forever without giving too much away. But
I'm going to give it away.
Okay. Him talking about all of the things he had purchased for his dead kid.
To the boy gets the gun. He's playing with it with his friend, and he shoots his friend. So then he is scared he's going to get into trouble. So he pulls his friend's lifeless body into a cave. This part is so grim. He sits in the cave for like 3 hours hoping he comes back to life. That doesn't work out. And eventually the Dragnet team get to the bottom of this, and it was a Christmas present, the gun. And the kid had gone into it early. And so there's a solution, sort of. The father's like, I'm going over to the boy's house, because the boy, sort of his friend, was the one who instigated some of this, maybe. Or if they weren't playing together, this wouldn't have happened. And like the detectives are like, oh, it's fine. Let him go. Don't intercede. So you think he's going over there to maul the kid. But no, he is toting an idea. And that idea is, kid, who has really killed my boy, I will give you his Christmas presents. And so the kid turns to his mom. He's like, Mom? And the mom, this is maybe the weirdest thing in the entire episode. She goes, I think that would be a swell idea. Yeah. It's like, is it? It seems like it's not. Like, right. It seems like a horrific idea where, like, the father's going to come out one day, and there you are with, like, your trikey, and he's going to freak out, and it's just not going to end well. Nothing ended well in the end. There you go, Dragnet.
I kind of wanted the little kid, the Stevie, I think it was, to go, I wish he got a bike, because I would have liked one of those.
Well, the kid had the Christmas of his life, in a way, but also... in the opposite way, too, at the same time.
And the
because when he's going over there, you think, like, uh-oh. This isn't going to go well. And then he hits upon this brainstorm, and he gives him this pitch, and it's, so far as I know, these Dragnet episodes were pretty faithful to, like, actual events.
Yeah.
And Dragnet became so successful that people tuned into this that, and this is funny, you can, like, it's pretty ropey that they did this. But they'd be like, hey, we're looking for a gun with a cream handle. Like, they just start, like, before the show starts, asking for tips. Here's the serial number. And you think, like, at the end, they qualify. They're like, look, this gun is really, really important. We need this gun back. And you just think, like, what the hell is going on? That, like, they have to advertise this, you to help out the cops, before now we'll begin the Dragnet program. So it's interesting. And this one is, I think, sort of there's some levity, because it's so over-the-top depressing that I laughed. I laughed out loud when he's like, I will give you his presents. I'm like, come on, dude.
Oh, I was laughing at the classic Joe Friday exchange with the dad. Where's my son? He's in his bedroom. Anything wrong?
That was weird.
He's hurt.
Yeah.
Is he hurt bad? He's dead.
Yeah, he's laid out for like this weird pre-funeral visit in his childhood room, which is not how that was. And he's like, can I go in there? He's like, yeah, take all the time you need. Right. And it's just, I've heard many of these Dragnets, and they don't usually do this, but it's like, I was thinking too, I mentioned that date of December 22nd. And the reason I bring that up is because if the air date had fallen on Christmas Eve, because Dragnet came on like later at night, later they would have this prefatory remark where it's like, this isn't for your kids, it's for you, the adult. Like, that was their tagline. But if this came on, or was scheduled to come on Christmas Eve, I don't think they could have done it. Like, I really don't think they could have. You couldn't have aired this at, like, 10 o'clock or whatever it is, as, like, you're putting out the actual present. So when they were scripting this, they must have actually looked at the days of the week and been like, yeah, we're okay. We would like buffer a few days.
Right. Well, it's okay on the 22nd. We can get away with depressing people 3 days before the holiday.
But it's a good show. And Friday is always like, he's in his early 30s. He's like, he never laughs. There's like no mirth in this guy. But it's such a detailed show. And this is what interests me. I was writing about this in the blog. I haven't put it up yet. Is that they will linger over sounds like no show I've ever heard. Like when they put a call through, you'll hear the phone ring 6 times and you'll hear the operator come on. You'll hear what the operator is doing through like this sort of muted voice. She's patching it through to some other place or whatever it is. They let that play out all the time. And the reason they do that is because of the believability.
Right.
That will pay off later with other maybe less mundane details. Because those details will count for more because you've been sort of absorbed into this very detailed milieu. And like Kafka did something along those lines with The Burrow. And that's what they're doing here. So you can really sort of knit up Kafka and American radio with Dragnet in the mid-20th century.
A very different type of radio production from, I believe, 1963. And we've talked before about the story, a wonderful version of M.R. James' Oh, Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad.
This has my man Michael Horden in it, and he's Marley in the film version of the 1951 film version of Scrooge that I just had the book come out on. And he was also Mr. M.R. James. He did a lot of readings of M.R. James. We've talked about a couple of those. And he was in the 1968 BBC TV version of Whistle and I'll Come to You, which was sort of the dry run for the Ghost Story for Christmas special. It was very popular in England in the 1970s. And there's a great version of Dickens's The Signal Man, which is probably the best one. Most of them are M.R. James. But this is from Christmas Eve, speaking of, in 1963. And you see some of the issues maybe with adapting this for the radio. I think there's really just one where the linen monster, because it's like a bedsheet monster, there's kind of this like bum note when Parkins, the professor, the doubting professor, the skeptic, and he sort of gets his comeuppance for not being open to things. And he's in his room and there's this extra bed, and the extra bed has some weird stuff going on, and because he blew this whistle. And the linen monster comes to life. He's like, ooh, who's over there? And the linen monster says, it is me! Really, you don't, like, if you're reading, you wouldn't, the linen monster doesn't speak inside the actual text and doesn't speak like in the 1968 version. But Horden is excellent, and it's just something that you'd sit there, you'd fire up some hot cider and sit down with this, and wonderfully evocative, and don't be a skeptic, be open to things. And I mean, it's the most popular, of course, of all M.R. James stories. I think it's like sort of the one that people think of the most when they think of him. And Horden is really effective as this skeptical guy who's this nebbish academic, this milquetoast type of person, and has his motives, but doesn't really have the courage to act on some of them. Doesn't like when people crowd his space, and then he gets his space crowded big time.
My favorite line is when the woman, I think maybe is the innkeeper, who says to the professor, I love strange stories, especially when told by an architect, an archaeologist.
Yeah, and it's funny because he's pulled into the like role of being an archaeologist, because that's not really what he is. But his friend, who's not really his friend, he's like, well, if you're going up the coast on your school vacation, I'd appreciate it if you sort of poke around like this burial cairn for me and see what happens, see if you find anything there. And so if people don't know the story, he just finds a whistle. And it seems like such a simple thing, and he blows the whistle later on. That's where the title comes from. Well, the title really comes from a line from the poet Robert Burns, but the whole, oh, whistle and I'll come to you, my lad. So he blows the whistle and he inadvertently summons this creature. And it might sound silly to people, that the idea of the bedsheet monster and all that, but there's a repressed sexuality aspect to this, homosexuality aspect. There's the academic who doesn't have physical commerce among his peers, men, women, anyone, sort of just alone with his books and believes in hard, straight science and facts and isn't open really to wonder. I think that's the lesson. And he gets saved, in essence, by like the only other person who's vacationing, who's lodging at this place, who's seen something along this line before. So he knows what to do, and he intervenes just at the right moment, and then spends the night. It's like subtle, but he spends the night in the same room, so to keep him company and make sure nothing else happens.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. Let's talk about a little Christmas music and a couple of very fun listens. Jerry Lee Lewis and a great version of White Christmas from I think 1964, in a version that showed in many ways the countryside of Jerry Lee for a big chunk of it, and then into the more traditional Jerry Lee style for the big finish to White Christmas.
He takes it at a brisk clip, I would say, much faster than anyone else does. And this is Jerry Lee Lewis. When he was the full-on killer, he had that whole persona going. And Jerry Lee Lewis, it's interesting because he's one of the early stars of Sun, but he doesn't record his second Sun album until 1961, because Sam Phillips wasn't a huge Jerry Lee Lewis fan after Lewis is like, 13-year-old cousin, I think I'll make you my bride. She's like, okay, Jerry, that'll be great. And so Sam Phillips had an issue with this, and he sort of like put Lewis off in the margins. And so by 1964, he's on a different label. It's the same year he makes the fantastic Star Club recording with the Nashville Teens in Hamburg. And so he's on a Saturday Club with Brian Matthews. And it can be like a bit of a shock hearing this presenter introduce Lewis rather than what you probably used to if you listen to music like this. And that's the Beatles. So it's the same air. It's the same MC, whatever you want to call him, host. And Jerry Lee Lewis is amazing on these sides. They're quite difficult to find, like all of them together. I mean, I'm having a devil of a time with it. But this version of White Christmas is not what you'd expect, really, from Jerry Lee Lewis. It's not like he has a ton of Christmas covers. And I think it's a great version. It really shows you what a solid singer he was. Really an expressive singer. And like I said, he makes it his own. He goes at a much faster clip than any other version I can think of with this song.
And Jerry Lee's an interesting guy because if you look at his career, I mean, he burst onto the scene there in the late 50s and blew up the rock charts, but then he was gone. That was it for him as a rock and roll recording artist. Most of his success in later years, and he had a lot of it, came on the country charts.
Yeah, he did. And he was really into the country mode, I'd say, by the late 60s. I mean, his last amazing year as a rock and roller was 64, because you don't just have the Star Club album. There's another album that's pretty much just as good called Greatest Live Show on Earth, and it was recorded in the South, another live in concert record. And but even then, he was still like doing the occasional country tune. It's almost like, I was talking to someone the other day, and I was telling them, they didn't have a clue, what was the earliest like someone could retire in a given sport and make the Hall of Fame? So it's like, would Patrick Mahomes be a Hall of Famer right now? And the earliest one I can come up with is Gretzky after 3 years. And then we started talking about players whose career, if they were in halves, each half is a Hall of Fame career. And like Ray Bourque is, I think, the best example of that. If you like take him through whatever, like 88, he's a Hall of Famer. And then you can start all over again. Like if he was a rookie, he'd be a Hall of Famer. Jerry Lee Lewis is like that. And I don't really care for like official Hall of Fames for music. I think that's daft. But on the rock and roll side, he's one of those pantheonic figures. Mm. And then he is too on the countryside. Like he did this about face in mid-career. And yet each time he was a rock and roller, he was a country musician, there were elements of the other genre. You see what I'm saying? Like
right.
What he was doing, like it was this countryfied rock in a way. And it was this rocked up country later when he was doing the other stuff.
I interviewed him back in the early 80s. I think he was doing a show here in Maine. And I remember him saying, I'm a country star now, but the killer, I invented rock and roll. They gave other people the credit, but I invented it. Yes, sir. Yes, you did.
Well, he was, that's what I mean by his killer persona. When he became this larger than life. Like he really adopted that personality. I feel like, I mean, he drags the Nashville teens through the performance of their lives at that Star Club date. And if you listen to him, though, like there's a live recording from 1961 when he was still on Sun, and he's not the killer as you think of him like later on. I mean, he's great and all that stuff. I'm not saying it's worse or it's better or anything like that, but he's not as overt with that persona. He's just kind of a gigging musician who's really good. And later, he's a gigging musician who's really good, but now he's also the killer. There's that added aspect.
Another unexpected Christmas delight, the Grateful Dead doing a fantastic cover with Pigpen on the lead vocal of Run, Rudolph, Run.
It's a great Chuck Berry song, right? And I was thinking about it today. I put something up on Twitter where the song starts with Chuck Berry saying, like, he's goading on Rudolph, like trying to like have Rudolph be more ambitious. Like Chuck Berry is Lady Macbeth to Rudolph in this. And he says, essentially, there's no reindeer close to you. You know you're the mastermind. That's a really weird thing to say to a reindeer, isn't it? Or anyone's like, look, man, these people can't compete with you. You're the mastermind. That's what you say to Lex Luthor or Gargamel. It's just strange, right? So Pigpen does a great job singing this. And the Dead, it doesn't seem like something one would think. But I think, along with the Beatles and the Stones, they are the finest Chuck Berry interpreters that we have. They did this amazing version many a time of Promised Land and would start some of the best shows with it in 1972. They did the smoking version of John and Be Good that's up there with the Hendrix version from Berkeley in 1970 and the 1964 Beatles version on the BBC with John Lennon on lead vocals. And they did this song a bunch of times in December of 71. So they did it today. They did it 50 years ago on this date in 1971 at the Felt Forum. And the guitar licks are perfect for the Grateful Dead. And they really burn on this. And Pigpen gets to scream his head off. And imagine that. You're at a Dead show. It's like, wow, this is wild. There's so many different styles of music coming at you, especially like in 71. And then they hit you with this. That would have been awesome. I would have been so excited to hear that.
And you've said it before here, the more you dig deeper into the Grateful Dead, you believe they're the greatest American band of all time.
Oh, yeah. They might be the best band, period, of all time. I think they, when I say American band, I mean any band, and I'm even including the Duke Ellington Orchestra. I think it just speaks to how people, they don't get things right. They don't look deeply enough into things, and they hear something, and they think it's boring old music for hippies, and I certainly couldn't be further away from the hippie mindset. I mean, the Zulu Warrior and the hippies, like, we are not, like, close brethren. The Zulu Warrior's like, let's battle hippies. And hippies like, hey, I'm just doing, like, slacking and watching Netflix and I'm high. And, like, just move on with something. So I'm not like that, but they're fascinating. They know the history and the musical history of this country so well, and then they just slice it up and put it out their own way and add new things. And The Jump, for instance, from the Fillmore West recording in 1969, spring of 69, or late winter, to what you're going to get in 1970 with Working Man's Dead and American Beauty, that is a bigger stylistic jump than any jump the Beatles ever made in their career. No one ever talks about the Grateful Dead that way. They just think jam band, which again is just it's a nonsense term.
I wanted to ask you, too, about the book. Scrooge is out now, and at least, I think, was it till the end of the month, you can get it for half off? Is that right?
Yeah, they're working on it because you can get it for half off if you're in Great Britain. So it's distributed in the States through a place called Oxford University Press, which is actually a pretty big press, and I tried it on there, and they're working on it right now. That discount only works if you buy it like through Liverpool University Press over in England. So you can get 50% off that way and still get shipped to you and everything. But the whole American domestic thing is just, I think I've mentioned this before, it's a mess right now with logistical things like this in publishing. But you can, like, for instance, if you wanted to, you can go on and get the EPUB version for 50% off tonight. Just get it through Liverpool University Press. Google will hook you up, and I'm sure it's on my website somewhere, something, and I'll just type it in on Google and you'll find it.
There you go. I ordered the paperback version myself.
That should be in your hot little heat miser hands pretty soon, I was told today. It'd be nice. I haven't seen it. You know, it's funny. It's like when I get my books, I don't even usually look at them. But I don't even have the option to look at this one. Like I got advanced copies for Brackets, which is coming out in January, like many months ago. I didn't even open the envelope because it makes me feel like a loser. I just care about the next thing, which isn't to say that this book's not great. Said that, and it is like a really special book. And I think you, Kimberly, can be like, oh, wow. Fleming wasn't lying this time. It actually was a really good one. I'm like, oh, Kimball, that hurts.
They always are. I look forward to it. Can't wait. We'll talk about it, I'm sure, in much more detail down the road. Until then, you have yourself a fine week. Stay warm. Make sure Hermie stays on his perch out in the hallway, and we'll visit next week.
All right. Sounds good, man.
Colin Fleming here on Downtown.